Hi there, I'm Jocelyn Seymour, teacher, former school leader, author and all-round cheerleader for teachers everywhere. Learning to read and write is a matter of social justice. Every child deserves to learn through evidence-informed practices, and every teacher deserves to be fully supported to make that happen. The Structured Literacy Podcast goes beyond the program to get to the heart of what it's really like to build a structured approach to literacy across a school. Let's go. One of the most common questions asked in Facebook groups about literacy instruction is this a science of reading resource? It's a question that usually ends up with a variety of answers ranging from, no, don't touch it, to, ooh, I love that one. Neither of these answers is actually very helpful if you are the teacher trying to wade your way through complex decision-making to get the best outcomes for your students. In this episode, I'd like to provide a little information and some ideas to consider when making decisions about whether a resource or program is evidence aligned. In last week's podcast episode, I shared my thoughts on the value of pre-prepared programs. As with most issues, there seem to be two ends of the opinion spectrum. Either we should only be using a program, or we should completely shun commercially produced programs and instead rely only on teacher capacity and knowledge. You can hear my thoughts on both of these viewpoints in the last episode. Now, if you know anything about me, you'll know that I'm a fan of prepared resources for teachers. Why should we spend hour upon hour creating everything from scratch? Why should we have to do the mental gymnastics that comes with connecting all the dots of what is, without doubt, a really crowded curriculum? I actually don't think we should. Sure, we have decisions to make and preparations to do, but nobody has the capacity to be a resource program designer and have the headspace and energy for the rigor of a school-based role as well. I really wish we'd move past the hero mentality that says that good teachers give everything they have to their profession. You know that saying, a teacher is like a candle that consumes itself to light the way for others? Well, you can probably tell from the tone of my voice, I really dislike it. This idea that a teacher should sacrifice themselves for their students and their profession suggests that the best teachers are exhausted and have no life, and that if you want to find a quicker, more efficient way to teach, that you are somehow cheating. I much prefer the saying, work smarter, not harder. I also think about this from a cognitive load perspective. If the extraneous load of the task of teaching is enormous because we are trying to make everything ourselves, we really don't have much left in the tank for the actual act of instruction. However, when we source great teaching resources and tools to support us, we have much more cognitive energy, emotional and physical energy for all that happens in the classroom. So let's say we have embraced the idea that it's actually okay to source resources, programs, and tools for our literacy instruction. We're then faced with the question, what should we use? There are many strong systematic synthetic phonics programs in Australia. These all have slightly different ways of organising the scope and sequence of teaching and also of how to conduct lessons. There are also many sources of decodable text that, again, use a range of scope and sequences and vary in the complexity of the text they present. When it comes to other tools, though, there are literally thousands of options to choose from. In recent times, with a growing awareness of the research findings of the science of reading and learning, creators of this content are aware that if they can align what they offer with the science of reading, and I'm putting my fingers up into speech marks, they are likely to sell more products. Now, I typed science of reading into Teachers Pay Teachers, and over 360,000 results came up. Now, some of those things were just fine. What I did find, though, was that many resources looked okay in terms of content, but were activities designed for children to use on their own. Other things were definitely not evidence aligned at all. Blends, sight words, tracing, copying, and good old guided reading were there in abundance. When we purchase a resource, any resource, and we don't have the knowledge about what the evidence of learning and reading is, we are relying on the creator of that resource to know things. If we don't have the declarative knowledge about instruction, if we don't know what we're talking about, it's really easy to find ourselves getting a bit sucked into the three Fs of teaching resources: fads, frippery, and falsehoods. How do we know if something we are seeing everywhere is a fad or if it's evidence aligned? How do we know that if something is frippery, and the official definition of that word is showy or unnecessary ornament in architecture, dress, or language? Frippery in teaching often takes the forms of fun, time-wasting games and activities that look nice but don't lead to any substantive student outcomes. And that leaves falsehoods, things that say that they are evidence-aligned but they aren't. Rather, they are built on someone else's interpretation of the evidence, or the evidence they base their claims on is questionable, such as with the research done by a certain balanced literacy company from the US that has started to take hold here in Australia. What's the solution? Well, I think the answer to this conundrum is to make sure that we as teachers and school leaders are aware of the features of structured literacy, and we need to know what we're looking for. Firstly, let's clarify what the science of reading actually is. And I can't say it any better than Louisa Moats when she wrote, "The body of work referred to as the science of reading is not an ideology, a philosophy, a political agenda, a one-size-fits-all approach, a program of instruction, or a specific component of instruction. It is the emerging consensus from many related disciplines based on literally thousands of studies supported by hundreds of millions of research dollars conducted across the world in many languages. These studies have revealed a great deal about how we learn to read, what goes wrong when students don't learn, and what kind of instruction is most likely to work the best for the most students." And you'll find this as a link to the show notes in Louisa Moats' work of Hard Words and Straw Men. So that link will be in the show notes for you. Now, you'll hear me talk about structured literacy, and you might wonder why I don't talk about the science of reading. Well, there's actually some key differences between the two. Nathaniel Swain from Think Forward Educators has described this to me as the main difference is that the science of reading encompasses all the findings, whether they relate to classroom practice or not. They can be highly theoretical or neurological stuff as well, and that may be nowhere near the classroom. Whereas structured literacy is the instructional approach that is put together from the science and is prescriptive about how to teach literacy based on what we know best from the science. So while I work to promote structured literacy, I'm a teacher, not a scientist or a researcher, and I can't claim to be highly knowledgeable about the science of reading because it does include all that higher order research and science that is just not in my purview. But in saying that, the science of reading is so well known that it would be unhelpful for me to ban it from my speech altogether. So I sometimes refer to either. Now that we've cleared up the finer points of terminology, let's get into some finer points of how we identify the good stuff when it comes to programs and teaching resources. Here are 12 key things that I recommend you look for when choosing resources and techniques for your classroom or school. Point number one, instruction needs to focus student attention on the internal structure of words. It doesn't ask them to learn those words as global shapes. Over time, students will come to internalize patterns of words and recall them automatically. However, the path to this automaticity is the knowledge of the alphabetic code. Linnea Eyre describes this knowledge as the glue that binds word recognition. Stanislas de Haan's research shows that even as proficient readers, we process words via sounds, but we process every sound in the word at once instead of one at a time. It takes 2 to 3 years to develop this automatic reading. To fully develop this knowledge, we include blending and segmenting with graphemes in our decoding lessons right from the start. And once phonics is established in the early years, we switch that focus to morphology. Not that we ignore morphology in the early years, that wouldn't be a good idea, but as a major focus of lessons, morphology takes us to the next step. Point number two. We are only asking novice readers to read things that they have learned the phoneme-grapheme correspondences and irregular high-frequency words for. Students are novice or beginning readers until they know a good chunk of the complex code and are building fluency. And you may need to apply this guideline for longer for at-risk learners. While context has a role to play in comprehension monitoring and later on in problem solving words we don't know, we really need to keep students focused on the sounds in the words. Giving them text to read that contains code they don't know when they're a beginning reader leaves children with no choice but to guess at the words from the pictures. And really paying attention to the internal structure of the word is a habit that is formed. And you and I have all seen what happens when students have had instruction that discourages this habit. Every time they come to a word that they don't know, they're guessing. So while children are learning the fundamentals of the code, make sure that reading material is aligned to their code knowledge and phonemic capacity. Point number three. We are working from simple to complex concepts and skills. Cognitive load theory tells us it's important to optimize the difficulty of a task. And we do this by not adding too many new pieces of information at once and not increasing the complexity of instruction before students are ready. In reading, this can take the form of learning the simple alphabetic code or the alphabet sounds, depending on how you want to think about it, before the complex ones. And reading text with simple vocabulary and sentence structure before we dive into rich text. And of course, we're going to read these to students until they can read them for themselves. We don't deny rich text until children can read them. They absolutely need to be in the mix. One of the ways this impacts our decisions is when it comes to how much code to introduce at one time, particularly when it comes to the complex code. Now, I don't think that there is any one perfect way to decide this. Different children will have different capacities for processing greater or smaller numbers of novel or new elements in instruction. Many of our students will be able to manage to learn two, three, or four ways to write a phoneme. So you might be teaching the sound A with the AY, the AI, and what's known as the split digraph A, and you might do that all at once. But our students with difficulties such as dyslexia or something that impacts on their working memory will likely find this hard. So it's important that we respond to that in our teaching. Now, this bit I'm about to say is completely my opinion, so please don't think that I'm saying that there's direct research evidence around this. But for my money, I'd rather that we teach all of our students in a way that supports the cognitive load of those who need that particular adjustment. We can absolutely do this without disadvantaging our more capable learners. And an alternative to teaching multiple graphemes of a phoneme at once is to teach one phoneme, grapheme correspondence at a time, and follow Carnine's advice and teach things that sound and look the same separately. That is, I'll teach one grapheme for A, the AY, then I'll teach IGH, then I'll teach the OA, then the OO. Then we'll go all through the code before we come back and teach them alternate spellings. What that does is it allows students to really embed things in long-term memory before we add something else that looks or sounds the same. So when I'm looking at resources, I want to know that my strugglers can keep up. I don't want to create a situation where I'm inadvertently widening the gaps in my students' achievement because I'm overloading some of them. Now, sure, you can differentiate how many graphemes particular students work with at once in our classes, but to me, as a teacher, that feels like it could get a bit messy. How do we track and monitor who knows what? And how do we know when we can go back? And it just feels like we would have lots of overlaps and mess and gaps potentially. You can also provide additional support for students who need more repetitions and exposures to keep up with the class. So that's where that tier two sits in. We know that some children have a learning profile that means they need more repetitions, and tier two extra practice may be the answer. But this does require a strong response to intervention processes and the consistent availability of additional adults to help make that happen. So when you review a program or resource, think critically about what people resources your school has available and what is actually achievable. Point number four, students need to learn pure sounds, not blends like spool and tr and nt. We also don't want to be teaching phonics with word families or phonics word families like the at family with hat and sat and bat, or the in family or the it family that teaches the last two sounds in a word as a unit. We want children learning phoneme-grapheme correspondences of pure sounds. We then teach the children how to blend and segment with these. Teaching blends and word families adds a significant amount of content for students to learn, and it really does misrepresent how the alphabetic code works. And over time, students will commit these patterns into long-term memory. But as with point number two, this occurs through great phonics teaching that includes explicit teaching of phoneme-grapheme correspondence and blending and segmenting with graphemes in every lesson. Point number five, instruction provides the most direct path to learning. Now, all too often, the activities that we give students to do are not bad in and of themselves, but they might not necessarily provide the most direct path to learning. An example of this could be cutting up sentences, putting them back together, and then copying them. Sure, a student might be decoding the words and placing them in the correct order, which would be a seemingly good thing. But is this the most direct path to learning? I'd suggest that simply reading and writing sentences as part of a systematic lesson would be a more efficient use of instructional time, not to mention save everyone's sanity where there's not lots of words all over the floor, and it will help consolidate skills much more effectively. The same goes for craft. Craft about letters or phonemes in the foundation year isn't wrong. It just means that it doesn't provide the most direct path for learning. If you want to do that, I suggest that it happens after lunch or some other time. Point number six, your instruction meets students at their point of need, providing sufficient practice and review to enable learning to mastery. Now, Stanislas Dehaene's four pillars of learning provide a framework for this strong learning. Opportunity for consolidation is a critical factor in anyone's learning. Without it, learning is never transferred to long-term memory, where it can be retrieved automatically and free up our attention to focus on other things. We need to review previously learned material in every lesson every day, and ideally this is built into the teaching routines. Point seven, decisions made about content and method of instruction respond to assessment data rather than the timing of a program. This one is really important. Any program is simply a tool that has strengths and limitations, and no program is going to replace your skill as a teacher. Part of that skill is tuning into your students' learning needs as revealed to you through targeted assessment. Now, this assessment and data collection could be formal or informal, but it will be regular, it will be reliable, and it will inform future teaching. It is the response of students that dictates the pace and complexity of instruction, not the decisions of a program developer. I'd suggest that you look for resources and programs that build formative and monitoring assessment right into the lessons, and that teacher decisions about when to move on in the scope and sequence are based on that. Point eight, learning is delivered via fully guided instruction rather than providing activities for students to do on their own. And again, this guideline comes back to Dehaene's four pillars. Our role as teachers, he tells us, is to direct student attention, ensure full engagement, provide error correction, and facilitate consolidation. Now, there's simply no way we can do this if we are not directly teaching our students. Instruction that is adult-led is always going to get superior results than instruction that relies on group rotations and activities. If an adult isn't present, directing student attention, who's to say that students are actually paying attention to what they need to learn? When we think about what Dehaene tells us, that the ability to concentrate doesn't fully develop until the late teenage years, expecting young children to learn on their own just is not the best plan. Point nine, instruction takes the form of explicit gradual release of responsibility and includes I do, we do, you do. Explicit teaching is supported by a vast body of research, and far from being about creating boring lessons with disengaged students, explicit instruction ensures that students are supported and that learning is scaffolded so that students can focus on the most important thing, which is what we want them to learn. The I do, we do, you do framework protects students from cognitive overload while remaining focused on continual growth in their learning. Be sure to look for instruction that maximizes the number of exposures or learning trials that occur in a lesson. Showing a card once or twice and having students repeat you when you say the phoneme is not going to get you the same results as 10 or 15 opportunities for students to read a card on their own or retrieve the grapheme when you say the phoneme and write it down. Supported practice in the skills we want students to develop is critical if we want all students to keep up and achieve well. Point number 10. Every student will be actively engaged in learning and their attention focused on the skill or knowledge being developed. Now, if we put points 6, 7, 8, and 9 into action, this will be evident. Active engagement means that students are creating mental models of what we are teaching. In phonics, they are making connections between phonemes and graphemes for both reading and writing. In morphology, students are learning the meanings of morphemes as well as how they are spelled and the spelling rules or guidelines that go with them. Partner work, low-stakes quizzing, creating word matrices, shared reading, and other things that we can do all mean that students are actively engaged. We don't have to become children's entertainers to keep our students engaged. When students know they are succeeding, they are going to want to pay attention. Point number 11, second last one. Graphemes are introduced right from the start of foundation. Now, there used to be a school of thought that children needed to have all the phonological sensitivities sorted out before we introduced blending and segmenting. But Susan Brady's work shows that this isn't the case. You don't have to wait for months to introduce blending and segmenting. These can be learned right alongside syllable division and rhyming, and phonics can be introduced within the first couple of weeks of the school year. Finally, our last point, your chosen program or resource is simple for teachers to resource and implement. And this last one isn't about the science of reading or learning, but is a bit of advice that I've come across from experience. When you're choosing a program or resource to implement across your school or cohort of classrooms, make sure it's simple to implement and comes with reasonably priced training options. The easy to implement part is a no-brainer. If something is complicated, we're simply not going to get the buy-in from every teacher that's needed for strong, consistent results. And if training is super expensive, you will likely find that the effectiveness of the program drops off over time. Not because the program won't continue to hold up, but because schools rarely have the budget to continue to spend thousands of dollars on training as new teachers come to the school. And I have to say, having a teacher show someone how to use a program in an after-school half-hour session is not training. This is why Reading Success in Action has QR codes that takes you right to videos of me explaining and demonstrating how to use everything. Now, all of this and more is available inside the Evergreen Teacher Membership that launched on January 1st, 2023. The guidelines I've shared with you today are not meant to be an exhaustive list of elements of evidence-informed practice in reading instruction, but they are intended to provide you with a quick and simple reference that you can use when you're making decisions for your classroom or your school. You can download a poster of the key points for your staff room or classroom from the Jocelyn Seymour Education site. There'll be a link in the show notes. And when you and your team are considering taking on a program or resource, go through these points and evaluate it against them. This all might seem very reasonable, this list of characteristics and my suggestions. But what if you've previously purchased a program or resources that don't meet your students' needs as closely as you would like? In short, you can make changes. If your program rushes students through the whole basic code without pausing for breath, you can slow it down and respond to the formative assessment you conduct in each lesson. If the program doesn't want you to introduce graphemes until the middle of the first year of school, move up the schedule. If upon considering your students' learning needs and examining the monitoring data, you think they would benefit from reducing the number of graphemes introduced at once, just simplify things. But don't have teachers going rogue on their own and changing the program in all sorts of ways, everyone in their own individual classrooms. Make the decisions together and base them in the needs of the students and what your data is showing you, not on personal teacher preference. If your phonics monitoring data shows that everything is progressing nicely, then keep doing what you're doing. If, however, your monitoring data shows you that there are students who aren't necessarily being served by what's happening, changes will be needed. Whether your current program or resource can be tweaked or not will be dependent on how many of the points mentioned in this episode are present. If your current approach teaches phonics in the context of picture books, has sight words taught as global shapes, gives students books to read that are full of sounds they haven't learnt yet, and provides only 15 minutes a day of teacher-led instruction in a two-hour block, really big changes are needed, and that probably will mean purchasing something new. If, however, there are some tweaks to pacing or complexity that will see you and your students cooking with gas, it isn't necessary to go and spend thousands of dollars on something new. But if you're looking for something new for your school, you now have a checklist to evaluate your choices. So let's wrap up by running through those 12 criteria for evaluating whether a resource or program is aligned with the evidence around reading instruction. Number one, instruction focuses student attention on the internal structure of words. It doesn't ask them to learn those words as global shapes. Two, you are only asking beginning and novice readers to read things that they have learned the phoneme-grapheme correspondences and irregular high-frequency words for. Three, you are working from simple to complex concepts and skills. Four, students learn pure sounds, not blends or word families. Five, instruction provides the most direct path to learning. Six, your instruction meets students at their point of need, providing sufficient practice and review to enable learning to mastery. Seven, decisions made about content and method of instruction respond to assessment data rather than the pre-arranged timing of a program. Eight, learning is delivered via fully guided instruction rather than providing activities for students to do on their own. Nine, instruction takes the form of explicit, gradual release of responsibility and includes I do, we do, and you do with loads of practice. 10, every student will be actively engaged in learning with their attention focused on the skill or knowledge being developed. 11, graphemes are introduced right from the start of foundation, as is blending and segmenting. And lastly, the program is simple to use and comes with sustainably priced training. There isn't one perfect program that does everything perfectly. That's not going to exist. But we can't rely on the badge Science of Reading Aligned either. We must know what we are looking for and be able to evaluate tools and resources before we use them. Thanks for joining me for today's episode. For more information about resourcing and professional learning to support you in your structured literacy journey, visit www.jocelynseemereducation.com.